Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Robert Service. He is a British historian, and he is currently a fellow at St. Anthony's College in Oxford and a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He joins us by telephone from Georgetown, Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thanks for having me on.
Your new book, Spies and Commissars, The Early Years of the Russian Revolution, is a very interesting book because we're looking at just a four-year period in Russian history, and I'm guessing this is a period that hasn't been covered very much.
Well, not in the way I've tried to cover it, because often the history of the October 1917 revolution is treated as something that only happened inside Russia, and I've tried to show that if you look at how Russia and the West interacted with each other, you come up with importantly different ways of understanding it all.
I had no idea just how chaotic it was inside Russia and what the elements were that made it possible for them to settle things down a little bit. I didn't realize that in 1921, the British essentially gave them a lot of help by making a trade agreement.
Yeah, the British government doesn't come out well from the research. At the end of the First World War, the Western Allies more or less stuck together. They might have made a few mistakes at the Treaty of Versailles and in Paris, but they stuck together. They formed a common front. And what happened 2 years later in 1921 was that the British signed a separate trade treaty with Lenin and Trotsky's government, at a time when there was enormous popular resistance to that government, so that to that extent the British helped to save the skins of Lenin and Trotsky.
And we have Lenin portrayed here. He's someone that you're extremely familiar with. You've written a definitive biography of him. He loves terror. Terror is his thing. And he comes across as being somewhat less resolute than I expected.
Yeah, he had a difficult situation to work out how to deal with, because after all, he'd come to power thinking that the support that he already had from the workers and the soldiers would continue to increase. But in fact, it didn't. So he faced a lot of problems in getting his administration consolidated, and he had to make concessions. But then he also used a huge amount of force, and he was a master of using both the stick and the carrot.
Mm. And we have a situation here where they were in the perfect place at the perfect time to take power, and yet they believed that Europe was ripe for this too. They thought that they could take over in Germany. They thought that they could take over in various capitals in Europe, but it wasn't true, was it?
No, it wasn't true. Europe was in a bad way. I mean, there'd been a terrible war, the worst war for a couple of centuries in Europe. And Central Europe and parts of Eastern Europe were really quite destitute. And that did make for a good breeding ground for extremist politics. But one way or another, the Western Allies, and America in particular, rescued the situation by sending in food aid. I mean, the work of Herbert Hoover was quite remarkable in this middle period of his career.
Now, was this Hoover before he became Secretary of Commerce that you're referring to?
When he was out there in charge of the American Relief Administration. He was quite a big figure already, and he was one of the principal advisors to Woodrow Wilson on how to stop Central and Eastern Europe going red, as had happened in Russia in 1917. So Hoover's advice was always, give them food. Give them food. This will help the American farmers, but above all, it'll save Europe from communist revolution. And remarkably correct he was. It did save the day.
And then later on, about 1920-21, when Warren Harding was president and Hoover was Secretary of Commerce, he actually offered the Russians a pretty sweet deal. He was going to give them a whole lot of free food and equipment, and the only thing they had to pay for was seed corn. But the Russians really were a little nervous about accepting this, weren't they?
They were, because they thought that that the Americans would use their food aid as a way of infiltrating agents into Soviet Russia and Soviet Ukraine, and it was only very reluctantly that they accepted the aid. But the aid did eventually go out there. It went out there later than it would have done had Lenin and Trotsky not been so so suspicious of the American policy.
My guest is Robert Service. His new book is Spies and Commissars: The Early Years of the Russian Revolution. Some of these spies are really fascinating characters. I think my favorite one had to be this Sidney Reilly character.
Yeah.
What a fellow.
Yeah. What an extraordinary enigma to leave behind. I mean, he's been called a double agent and a triple agent. He certainly was one of the most colorful of spies in the 20th century. You know, you tend to think of spies as trying to be very discreet and very low-key and not to be noticed. But this was a man who, no sooner had he landed in Soviet Russia in 1918 than he demanded an interview with Lenin himself. he put himself about. He had chutzpah, extraordinary chutzpah. I've looked at some of the letters that he wrote, such of them as have survived. I've come to the conclusion that he wasn't a double agent, but that he was a single agent, and he was an agent on behalf of Sidney Reilly.
Some of the most fascinating material in here, to me, was reading about the telegraph traffic and how there was surveillance of it, and it almost reminded me of our modern device of email. There was some sort of a device that they were using where they weren't coding their messages, and they were being watched by the British and the Americans, and really amazing stuff.
Yeah, that was. I'm glad you brought that up. That was quite a surprise for me, and of course, being British with all of our saga of the hacking of emails and telephones going on in our country at the moment, this is very, very reminiscent of all of that. The British and the French and the Americans were very, very astute about their use of the telegraph, and the result of that was that the Western Allies knew really most of the basic things that they needed to know about the communists, not just through the human beings who they sent out as spies, but through the brilliant technologists who caught the messages that were passing among the Bolsheviks.
You write in the book, there's one statement near the end that really struck me. And I would love it if you would describe how you came up with the statement. You say, Bolsheviks were engineers of the soul.
Yeah, because that was a phrase used by one of the pro-Soviet novelists, Maxim Gorky. Their idea was not just that they would change politics or change the economy, but they would change the whole of human existence. had changed the nature of people. So that, and they thought in very mechanistic industrial terms. So they were quite proud of being engineers of the soul. They thought that the true basic potential of people, ordinary working people, had never been realized because of the way that the market economy worked against them. And that if all of this could be put in reverse, if everything could be turned on its head, if the world could be turned upside down, then there would be thousands of Aristotles, thousands of Shakespeares pouring up from the working class, and that the whole history of humanity would be different. So alongside being very dictatorial, they were also true believers. They really believed in their doctrines.
And Lenin, who died so remarkably young, I think he was only 54, he was such an atheist. I wonder what he would think about the almost cult-like following that developed after his death and the fact that he is still on view publicly like some sort of religious idol.
Yeah, I don't think he would have liked it very much. I mean, he didn't really like the personal attention, except that he was a very practical man, and he didn't really stop this cult before it got out of hand. But he would never have allowed himself to be mummified, embalmed, put under glass, and displayed forever in a mausoleum on Red Square. That would have been something he would have considered to be quite disgusting. And you know, I think it is disgusting. Mm-hmm. It is disgusting, and Russians have got so used to it that they can't see what's objectionable about this practice, because Lenin, after all, was responsible for the deaths of so many Russians. I mean, to turn him into a national hero is bad enough, but to imply that he was some sort of secular saint, that's really beyond any kind of acceptability, I think.
Robert Serbus joins us. Robert is a fellow at St. Anthony's College in Oxford, a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. His new book, Spies and Commissars, The Early Years of the Russian Revolution, just published. I just saw an article the other day in the New York Times speculating that Lenin's stroke might have been caused by suspicious means. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, his medical history is the subject of a lot of commentary. Years ago, when I went into it, I got the reports written by one of his Russian doctors. And it's clear that they were a bit baffled by what was wrong with him. They knew there was something fundamentally wrong, but they weren't totally sure. One of the medicines that they gave him indicated the strong possibility that they thought that he had syphilis. He certainly had very many cardiac incidents that meant that he wasn't going to be very long for this world, whether or not he had syphilis. He actually asked Stalin for poison so that he could kill himself. Mm. He wanted to commit suicide. He knew he was a goner. Mm. But Stalin, unusually for Stalin, probably the only time in his life, decided that it wouldn't be a good idea that a particular person should die.
That is unusual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A first and last.
Looking at all this, it was intriguing to me. Obviously, if you were in a position of power with the Bolsheviks at that time, health was a very difficult thing to maintain. You point out the fact that they were getting ready to go to a conference and almost all of them were laid up. Even Stalin had appendicitis. I think there was only one that was even relatively healthy out of the whole group.
Yeah, they'd live life in the most intense way since the October Revolution. They'd hardly slept. They hadn't lived luxuriously, not yet anyway. Their health suffered, so that by the time they won the Civil War, in the early years after the October Revolution, they all needed a rest. And the only man who was in charge of things in 1921, when so many of the big decisions were made that ensured the survival of the Soviet administration, was Lenin himself. And, within a year, Lenin was suffering heart attacks, and 2 years later he died.
The book is Spies and Commissars, The Early Years of the Russian Revolution, written by Robert Service, and just published by Public Affairs. You were born in October 1947, which is really when the Cold War was starting to ratchet up. How did you become so fascinated with this period of history?
Well, I started off studying Russian literature, and I found that a lot of the questions that I wanted to answer were involved with the history of the 20th century, and so I gradually drifted into trying to answer them, and I ended up studying Soviet communism rather than Russian literature.
I am fascinated by Trotsky, and I love the account that you have in here of a sculptor, a woman, coming to Russia, and she sat down with Trotsky, and she had him pose, and that's a really interesting exchange between them. He was sort of interested in her in a less than platonic way, it sounds like.
Yeah, he does seem to have flirted with her. Whether it went beyond that, no one knows. But the most remarkable thing about that woman, Claire Sheridan, is that she was the cousin of Winston Churchill. She went out to do all this work as a sculptor out in Moscow on the quiet. She knew that Churchill would have tried to stop her if he knew where she was going. So when she got out there, she was quite a sort of flamboyant lady. She had a wonderful time, and was particularly attracted. She really rather fancied Trotsky. And I'm pretty sure Trotsky really fancied her as well.
Robert Service joins us. His book is Spies and Commissars, The Early Years of the Russian Revolution. So many fascinating characters here, and so many obscure figures. Another one of these spies who possibly was a double agent was a fellow named Robert Lockhart.
Oh, yes.
Another very interesting fellow.
Yeah. A man who was at the heart of the British establishment, unlike Sidney Reilly, but a man who had an independence of thought that appealed to David Lloyd George. And so he was sent out as the personal emissary of David Lloyd George to see if some sort of accommodation could be found with the Soviet government that had so far eluded the Western Allies. Just like Sidney Reilly, he thought of his job as being something that he could do for part of the day, and the rest of the time he spent womanizing. They all seem to have had a sort of James Bond-type attitude to the job of espionage.
Another intriguing aspect of this was the fact that while the revolution was going on, the World War was going on, and of course it was in the best interest of the Allies that Russia would stay in the war, and with things collapsing back in Russia, this was not going to happen. The Russians were going to pull back and give the Germans the opportunity to move those forces to the other edge of the war. And all the interesting manipulation that went on to try to get the Russians to stay in and to see what was going along those borders. That was fascinating to me. And I also didn't realize that the Polish had occupied so much land during the same period.
Yeah, you're right to bring this up, because when the Russian Empire fell apart, then it wasn't immediately self-evident that there would be new nation states with very easily defined boundaries in Eastern Europe, such as Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Poland. And that whole area was fought over more or less from the end of the First World War onwards. The communists in Russia wanted to get that land back, but they also wanted to carry the revolution to the West. They wanted to carry it over Poland, and they wanted to break their way through to Germany.
We are speaking to Robert Service. His new book is Spies and Commissars, The Early Years of the Russian Revolution. He joins us by telephone from Washington, D.C. And Robert is a fellow of St. Anthony's College in Oxford and a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. I understand that you were recently called as an expert witness in a very interesting trial in London. Can you talk about that at all?
Yes, it's a trial that's still going on. I was called as an expert witness on the politics of the economic transition in Russia. And there is a big disagreement between two of the so-called oligarchs, two of the biggest big businessmen, in the late 1980s, early 2000s, about their commercial relationship one with the other. It's an enormous trial involving $7 or $8 billion.
Oh my!
And it was quite a spectacular event. The verdict has not yet been announced, and it won't be announced until July. As one of the witnesses, I'm not really in a position to be able to say much about it.
Yeah.
Except that, you know, if you look at the whole of the 20th century and into the 21st century, Russia has always been a place where really the strangest things happen.
Uh-huh. Yeah, now we're having the revolving chairs. They just put Putin back in as president. Very fascinating to observers over here.
Yes, and strangest of all was the idea that somehow President Medvedev might be somehow very different from his predecessor, President Putin. But now we can see that the tandem arrangement between the two was a gross deceit of the Russian public. And that's why there are so many demonstrations going on against the third term President Putin to this day.
Our guest is Robert Service. His new book, Spies and Commissars, The Early Years of the Russian Revolution. I love this cover. What a wonderful cover. Where did they come up with this?
That's from a poster from the early revolutionary period. My publishers in America have really done me proud with. I do agree. It's a wonderful book cover. Yeah,
very eye catching. And I'm guessing someone like you, who has written so extensively on this period and on Russia, that you're working on another project. You've probably been working on it for a while. Is there a project that you're working on as far as another book?
Yeah, I'm working on a book on the ending of the Cold War at the end of the 1980s.
Uh-huh.
It's really a companion volume to Spies and Commissars. I thought I'd do the same thing for how the Soviet regime collapsed and how the Cold War ended in the way that it did, as a sort of mirror image of how the Russian Revolution happened in the first place in 1917.
So it's a bit of a bookend then to this book.
It is indeed, yeah.
I know that things really opened up after that happened, but then I understand that things kind of got more restricted as far as access to information. Have you found it more difficult, say, in the last 10 years to...
Oh, yes, yes. Really, the greatest window of opportunity was in the first 2 years after the fall of the Soviet Union. From about 1993 onwards, it got more restrictive, more difficult. And under Vladimir Putin, there's definite political interference with what goes on in the writing of history, alas. I mean, you have to feel sorry for the Russians. They don't deserve the governments that they've had.
Mm. You also have some wonderful photos in the book. And I think my favorite one is the photo of these two men who ran the Cheka. And Felix, is it Dzerzhinsky?
Yes, Dzerzhinsky, yeah.
What an interesting picture of him. What a strange man.
Yeah, sort of very ascetic, very fanatical, gleaming-eyed man who apparently didn't like the torments that he inflicted on people. He wasn't a direct sadist, but he certainly had the ability to apply with clinical precision a mass terror, a red mass terror. He was a Pole, of course, himself.
Uh-huh.
And paradoxically, you know, although he was a fanatical communist, he did see that there would be trouble for the Red Army when they tried to overrun Poland in 1920, which is something that Lenin, the Russian, didn't understand at all. But of course, the Poles didn't want any Russians, whether they were red or white, running over their country.
Mm. Well, it's a fascinating book, and we really appreciate you taking time to talk to us about it today.
Well, it's been a real pleasure, and it's great to talk to you, meet you over the phone.
The book is Spies and Commissars, The Early Years of the Russian Revolution, written by Robert Service, and we'll look forward to that next book. Do you have a date when you're hoping to complete it?
Well, I'm hoping to knock it out in the next year or two. The pile of information that's coming out of the American and Russian archives is quite enormous. It makes for an interesting life.
Super. Well, thanks again, and hopefully we'll track you down for that next book.
That's very good of you to say that. Thanks.
The book is Spies and Commissars, The Early Years of the Russian Revolution. Robert Service has been our guest. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. Do you remember the original episodes of Star Trek? The poor schlub in the red shirt would always be the one who, when they went down to the planet's surface, the monster would get him. Well, think about that, and be sure to tune in next week as we talk to John Scalzi with a very funny new work of science fiction. It's called Red Shirts in the Book Nook, right here on WYSN. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.